From WHYY in Philadelphia, I am Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The Broadway revival of Gypsy, starring Tyne Daly, has just received 5 Tony Award nominations. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Arthur Lawrence. He directed the revival and wrote the book for the original 1959 production. Also, we meet musicians Tom and Ian Spanik, their father and son, and the leaders of the rock band, the Spanik Boys. Rock historian Ed Ward plays us some tapes from the day Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, and Johnny Cash all shared the same studio. And book critic John Leonard reviews Mark Hudson's African memoir, Our Grandmother's Drums. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Flooding continues to drive people from their homes in Arkansas, Texas, and Oklahoma. The Arkansas River reached record levels today at Little Rock, forcing the removal of an estimated 325 families. Ben Fry of member station KUAR in Little Rock has this report.
Ron Helton of the Army Corps of Engineers in Little Rock says the river has crested at nearly 28 feet today. This is the highest level ever recorded at Little Rock. Helton says the river at Pine Bluff, Arkansas, may reach near 48 feet tomorrow.
That's 1 foot above flood stage. Now, there's some people who have built in the floodplain in lower levels there and have thought that they were safe, and they were not.
Many homes have already suffered damage from flooding in Pine Bluff, and 8 people have been treated for snake bites. Floodwaters have driven the snakes to higher ground. For National Public Radio, I'm Ben Fry in Little Rock.
Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton says his state is going to need massive help from the federal government once all the flood damage is toted up.
Well, we'll need the full range of federal disaster assistance. We'll need the public assistance to fix the streets and roads and bridges and water and sewer systems. We'll need personal assistance to help the people who've been thrown out of their homes and don't have anything to live on or to live in. And we'll need, obviously, the help from the Small Business Administration and the Agriculture Department for the farmers and business people that have been hurt. We've got an awful lot of damage here.
In Texas, flooding along the Trinity River was the region's worst in 80 years, with more than 1,600 people seeking shelter. Hundreds of people were forced to leave the area around Oklahoma's Lake Texoma, which crested 27 feet above normal. In the past 2 weeks, floods are said to have contributed to 13 deaths in Texas and 1 in Oklahoma. Tomorrow on Capitol Hill, the House is scheduled to begin debate on the Family and Medical Leave Act, a bill which would require businesses to provide 12 weeks of unpaid leave to care for sick family members or newborn babies. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
The bill would only affect businesses that employ 50 or more workers at a single site. That covers only 5% of all American companies, but nearly 44% of all American workers. The White House has threatened to veto the bill. Today, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that the president would like companies to provide parental leave to workers on a voluntary basis, but that the president opposes any law that would force them to do it. The bill's sponsors, a broad coalition of Democrats and Republicans in the House, are casting this bill as a family issue. The bill is expected to pass the House, although not by a margin large enough to override a presidential veto. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Prices were higher at the close of the New York Stock Exchange today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, which rose more than 11 points yesterday, gained almost 12 points today to close at 2,733.56. Advances led declines 4-3. This is NPR News. Costa Rica's new president was sworn in today. He's Rafael Calderon, widely regarded as more conservative and more pro-American than his predecessor, Oscar Arias. First Lady Barbara Bush and Nicaraguan President Violeta Chamorro were among the official representatives at the inauguration. Calderon promised a government of national consensus driven by private enterprise. He also told a crowd of 50,000 to expect austerity measures to control inflation and reduce his country's budget deficit. A study in the latest Journal of the American Medical Association shows that olive oil is no better at protecting against heart disease than most other vegetable oils. NPR's Michael Scholar has more.
Olive oil and other monounsaturated fats seem to have an advantage over polyunsaturated fats like corn and safflower oil. All the oils help people lower their cholesterol, but olive oil seemed to lower only the bad cholesterol component, LDL, while it maintained the good HDL cholesterol that protects against heart disease. These early findings came from studies where people received large amounts of monounsaturated oil, more than they would eat in a balanced diet. But the new study tested people on what's become the recommended low-fat diet for all, a diet that limits saturated fat and total fat consumption. And the study found that volunteers had the same HDL and LDL cholesterol levels whether they ate more monounsaturated fats, like olive oil, or whether they ate polyunsaturated fats. The researchers say what's important isn't the oil you use, but your overall diet. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
Pro-independence forces in the Baltic republics of Estonia and Lithuania took further steps today to pull away from the Soviet Union. The Estonian parliament passed a resolution saying that Soviet laws are not valid in Estonia. It also dropped the word Soviet socialist from the republic's name. Estonia declared its independence on March 30th. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Tony Award nominations were just announced, and the revival of Gypsy is nominated for 5 awards, including Best Revival and Best Leading Actress in a Musical. Tyne Daly of Cagney and Lacey fame stars as Rose, the quintessential stage mother. Ethel Merman was Rose in the original 1959 Broadway production. Gypsy has one of Broadway's great scores, with songs like Everything's Coming Up Roses, Some People, and Small World. Julie Stein wrote the music, Stephen Sondheim the lyrics. My guest Arthur Lawrence wrote the book, based on the memoirs of stripper Gypsy Rose Lee. The current revival of Gypsy is also directed by Lawrence. His other Broadway credits include writing the book for West Side Story and directing La Cage aux Folles, I Can Get It For You Wholesale, and Anyone Can Whistle. Lawrence wrote the screenplays for several films, including The Way We Were, The Turning Point, and Alfred Hitchcock's Rope. I spoke to Arthur Lawrence soon after the current production of Gypsy opened and asked him why he decided to do the revival.
Because I was asked to, and I loved the show, and it seemed I felt that enough time had passed that the show could finally be done the way I thought it should be done. When it originally played in New York, it was considered a very tough, unpleasant show. And the production was really rather sweet. It laid off a lot of things that, it being 1989, I was able to do. It's very different from the other productions. It goes much more deeply into the relationships, into what I would call the dark side of it.
What's an example of something that was too unpleasant for the original production that you could go into now?
Well, it still is. I mean, Mother is still sacrosanct in America. And a lot of people don't like seeing this woman who is not the most pleasant mother in the world. But also there is the relationship between Rose and Herbie the agent is extremely sexual now. It has elements of romance, but it's distinctly a man-woman relationship. That was never played before.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the original production, Ethel Merman starred as Rose.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from what I've read about the original production, you weren't really satisfied with her performance.
You didn't read that anyplace.
Well, what I read was that you referred to her as an opening night performer, someone who gave her all on opening night.
Yes, she gave her all, but
After that, it kind of diminished a little bit.
That's true. I'm very grateful to Merman because I don't think they would have done the show without her,
mm-hmm.
even though she was on the skids, as it were, at that time. She had had a flop or two, and as a matter of fact, the show opened with almost no advance. And if we hadn't gotten good reviews, but David Merrick, the producer, told me we'd play 6 weeks and that was it. She did us a great service. And for that time, she was terrific. But it was never what I felt the performance should be.
Well, I read that one night you had a talk with her in front of the whole cast about her performance, about her not giving her all. What did you say to her?
I don't know where you read that.
I think it was in Sondheim and Company.
Well, it's only semi-true.
Mm-hmm.
What it was, I don't think she wasn't really an actress. She didn't know she had taken to walking through the show. But what I called her on was that she and Jack Klugman, who was played opposite her, the show had been running 6 months, and they were breaking up on stage, telling each other jokes, which I think is insulting to an audience. The audience comes, make them laugh, not each other. And I called her on that.
What was her reaction?
Oh, it was as though she were a naughty little child who'd been spanked. She took it.
Mm-hmm.
And went right on doing it again.
Now, you directed the 1973 London production of Gypsy with Angela Lansbury.
Right.
And I just know this production through the cast recording, which I think is wonderful. Tell me about casting Angela Lansbury in the part and directing her in the role of Rose.
That, again, was totally different. She's a very fine actress, and they wanted to do the show in London. It had never been played in London because when it originally opened, Merman was going to do it in London, and then some agent unwisely convinced her, and she unwisely let herself be convinced, that she was so terrific that she should go on a concert tour of the United States. So she refused to do it in London. They would have no substitutes, and her concert tour did not do well, which is the understatement of this interview. So it had never been done in London, and they wanted to see it. And the producers wanted Angie. I knew her. I'd worked with her before. And we did it in London. And again, it was different from this production because the emphasis was more on the comedic quality. She's a really terrific comedian, Angela. And Rose was quite a reach for her. There's a kind of earthiness, if you will, trashiness about Rose that's very difficult for Angela to get. But in her own terms, she was terrific. There was no relationship between her, again, and the agent.
Tyne Daly is starring in Gypsy, in the current production of Gypsy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you knew she could sing before you gave
her. She came in an audition for us.
Uh-huh. Were you surprised?
Yes, very. And she sang for Julie Stein, Steve Sondheim, Barry Brown, the producer. It was his idea. She was his idea, and myself, and we were all very surprised.
Is a TV star considered an advantage or a liability on Broadway?
I don't know how Broadway considers it. In my opinion, it can be a liability. It is not an advantage. A TV star doesn't sell tickets. I think there are two reasons. One is usually TV stars schlep around productions in summer stock, they're shoddy, and the people have gotten burned. And they also see these people for free. Then it comes to New York, and they think, well, there's a snobbery. I must say in many cases justified in New York that a TV star simply doesn't have the background. In Tyne's case, what helped a lot was that she was on the road with this for 26 weeks before it came in, which was very valuable time to learn how to perform in musical theater and to learn how to perform Rose.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the book for the Broadway musical Gypsy and directed the 1973 London production of it and is directing the current Broadway production of Gypsy, which stars Tyne Daly. There are wonderful songs in Gypsy. Now, I've heard Stephen Sondheim, who wrote the lyrics for Gypsy, say that he sometimes likes to incorporate lines from the script right into a song so that the lyric is really speaking the mind of the librettist, the person who wrote the book. Did that happen in Gypsy?
It happened a lot. Steve is wonderful to collaborate with, and he thinks I am, because I say, go ahead, raid the dialogue. For example, the first line of Mr. Goldstone, have a Negro, Mr. Goldstone, was taken from the dialogue. But he means really more than that. He is one of the too few lyricists who knows that each character speaks differently and sings differently. They have a different diction. So he waits, or he waited in the case of Gypsy, for example, till I would write the characters. He would see how they would speak. That affected what lyrics he wrote for them. Their language is different.
When you're writing the book for a musical, do you have a sense in your mind of where the songs belong and what the transition into the song is going to be like?
Total. That's the way I write. I plan for that.
Mm-hmm.
I do as much as possible to write into the music. Let the music take over. Lift the characters to the point where they can't do anything else but sing.
Can you give us an example?
Yes. At the end of the first act of Gypsy, there's a song called Everything's Coming Up Roses, which if you haven't seen the show, you think is a kind of happy, jazzy Broadway tune. What happens with that song is one of the reasons why I don't want it, and we all don't want it to be made into a movie again. What is done with that song you can only do on the stage. You can't do it in the movies because movies are too literal. What happens is a woman literally goes off her rocker and bursts into that song. This is a woman who suddenly has an enormous disappointment. She's furious. She's angry. She rages. And she rages until she can't anymore, and it comes out musically. It's against the emotion. It's all this ridiculous, insane optimism that this woman has. And it's done in music.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we listen to Everything's Coming Up Roses? Angela Lansbury singing. This is from the London production that you directed in 1973.
And just remember that listening to her
mm-hmm.
are her daughter and her lover, and they are terrified and stunned by this woman's madness.
I had a dream about you, baby. It's gonna come true, baby. They think that we're through, but baby, you'll be swell, you'll be great. Gonna have the whole world on a plate. Starting here, starting now, honey, everything's coming up roses. Clear the decks, clear the tracks. You've got nothing to do but relax. Blow a kiss, take a bow, honey, everything's coming up roses. Now's your inning.
That's Angela Lansbury from the 1973 production of Gypsy, which was directed by my guest Arthur Lawrence. Arthur Lawrence also wrote the book for Gypsy and is directing the current production of Gypsy on Broadway, which stars Tyne Daly. He also wrote the book for West Side Story and the screenplays for The Way We Were, The Turning Point, and Rope. His directing credits include La Cage aux Folles, I Can Get It for You Wholesale, and Anyone Can Whistle. We'll take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Arthur Lawrence is my guest. Do you ever feel that the librettist gets the least credit in a musical? You know, in a musical, you always hear so much more sometimes about the songwriters.
Every librettist feels that, and it's accurate. No musical is ever referred to as the work of the librettist. It is only referred to in terms of the composer and, if the lyricist is as famous as Steve Sondheim, the lyricist. I think that goes back to opera, where you don't know who wrote the libretto for the operas. Mm-hmm. You only know the composer. And I think one of the reasons we don't have more and better playwrights writing musicals is that everybody has a need for recognition, which is, by the way, what Gypsy is really about. And it is so frustrating not to get any recognition for what one has done in creating a musical that a lot of playwrights simply won't try. And you get the people write letters to the Times and the critics say, oh, yes. And then for 2 minutes they recognize the librettist and then they don't.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply a given. The reason I do it is I just love musical theater. And I love writing them. I'm stuck.
Let me ask you about the book that you wrote for West Side Story. Now, I believe the idea for a musical based on Romeo and Juliet was the choreographer Jerome Robbins.
That's right.
Well, how did he originally pitch it to you? What was the initial idea he proposed?
The initial idea was quite different from what it was. It was about a Jewish girl and a Catholic boy in New York over Easter and Passover. And I thought that was A.B.'s Irish Rose, and I wanted no part of it. And then several years passed, and I happened to be in California, and Lenny Bernstein was in California. By that time, juvenile delinquent gangs had come into being. And on the coast, there was a great problem with Chicanos, which in New York was Puerto Ricans. That's where the idea came from, the front page. And that's what the... And then Lenny and I called Jerry and said, we're ready to go.
Did you have any reservations about singing and dancing gangs?
On the stage, no. In the movie, yes.
Mm-hmm.
On the stage, the stage is total illusion. You come into a box, and you see this proscenium, and then people hop on and hop off. There's an orchestra in the pit. But people have imagination, and the theater makes you use it. And you will accept almost anything. But movies, to me, are either... The nature of the medium is such that movies are either realistic, by that I mean naturalistic, or surrealistic. To me, in the movie A West Side Story, I know it was a great hit, but when those boys came tourgeting down the street, I didn't believe it for a minute. I still don't.
Now, you didn't write the screenplay for Gypsy or West Side Story. Did you want to?
I wasn't asked to write the screenplay for West Side Story, and I wanted to. I was asked to write the screenplay for Gypsy, and I was going to till they told me they cast Rosalind Russell, and the director was Mervyn LeRoy, and I bowed out. We had wanted Judy Garland. They didn't because they said she had a weight problem. But of course, with the passage of time, Gypsy covers 15 years, even if she had a weight problem. If the white weight went up and down, it wouldn't have mattered.
Mm-hmm. What'd you think of the movie?
Of Gypsy?
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's a candidate for one of the worst movies I ever saw.
So, you know,
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. The only good thing in the movie was Natalie Wood.
Uh-huh.
R.I.P.
Well, just give me a sense of what you hate about the film.
Well, Rosalind Russell was very busy being Rosalind Russell. Again, she was wonderful in Wonderful Town. She's wonderful when she played this, what they used to call a dame. This hard-driving, executive, smart-cracking, certainly middle-class, if not upper-middle-class, woman. This is nothing from this blousy, vulgar, common, trashy Rose. I mean, she wore chic clothes. I remember her black and white high heels in the train station. It was just all off.
Now, you're the director. Do you go night after night to the theater?
I certainly do not. I'm working on a new show, happily, gladly.
When is it time for you to stop going?
Never. I go back every certain number of weeks to check up on them and, as in the immortal words of George Kaufman, remove the improvements.
So the new musical that you're working on now is?
Nick and Nora.
This is based on The Thin Man?
Based on the characters, just those two characters in The Thin Man. The story is entirely new, and it has a score by Charles Strauss and Richard Maltby, Jr.
Now, how do you turn Nick and Nora Charles into the characters of a musical? What makes the story a musical?
That is one of those imponderables. It depends on if you see it that way. To me, these are two people. When I tell you this phrase, you'll see what makes it a musical. To me, these are two people who were dancing through life. Now, the difference in the stage version in the movies is, to me, they've been married 5 years and the steps are beginning to change and they're beginning to stumble here and there. But you see, the minute you say dancing, you get a visual, it's a metaphor, but it's also a reality. Their first entrance, they literally come dancing in.
You've written for movies and for the stage.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the primary differences between writing for the two forms?
The other day, there was a movie I was considering writing. Oliver Stone was going to produce it, and he called me up and said, why don't you want to do it? I said, Because the day I finish the script, I'm out on my ass. I wrote my first movie in, I think, 1948. This is now 1990. There's a lot of talk, but essentially, the attitude has not changed. The writer is low man on the totem pole. Where they woo you and they'll pursue you. He's the least paid, comparatively, of the actors and the directors. And the great God in Hollywood, as in this country, is money. That determines respect. And once they have the script, as it says in Gypsy, so long, Rose, don't slam the door as you leave. You're out. And they do. Not only do they cast and play it as they want, they rewrite it as they want.
Now, one of your screenplays, The Way We Were, which you also wrote a novel of the same name, there's blacklisting in that, in Hollywood. Were you ever blacklisted yourself?
Absolutely, in The Witch Hunt. Mm-hmm. And there's an example of what they do. The climactic scene in that story, in that movie, was shot and neatly cut out.
What was the scene?
The scene was where the Barbara Streisand character says to the Robert Redford character, he says to her, the studio says I have a subversive wife and they will fire me unless you go and become an informer. And he wants her to inform, to save his butt. And she says, well, there's a very simple solution. Willy-nilly circumstances force you into this. I will get a divorce, you won't have a subversive wife. What they kept was willy-nilly circumstances force you into a solution. I will get a divorce. The whole business about informing and subversion, which was what the picture was basically about, they cut out. They said the public doesn't want it. They want a romance. How did they know? I don't know. Maybe they looked in a crystal ball. But it's so unsatisfying. The picture was a great success. But what I wanted to say in that picture, what the picture was about, gets thrown out with the garbage. So it's not very interesting, exciting, fulfilling. I could go on with the words for me to work in movies. The theater with all its handicaps is exciting and a bigger challenge, and you can do more and you have more fun.
Well, I wish you continued success with the current production of Gypsy and good luck with your future production as well of Nick and Nora. Thank you so much, Arthur Lawrence, for talking with us.
Thank you.
Arthur Lawrence wrote the book for Gypsy and directed the revival, which is currently on Broadway, starring Tyne Daly. It's just been nominated for 5 Tony Awards. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be Andrew Weil. He's a physician and medical researcher who specializes in alternative medicine and medical botany. Here's Tyne Daly from the new cast recording of Gypsy.
Anybody that stays home is dead. If I die, it won't be from sitting. It'll be from fighting to get up and get out. Some people can get a thrill knitting sweaters and sitting still. That's okay for some people who don't know they're alive. Some people can thrive and bloom living life in a living room. That's perfect for some people of 105. All the places I gotta play, all the things that I gotta be, yet come on, Papa, what do you say? Some people can be content playing bingo and paying rent. That's peachy for some people, for some humdrum people.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's Tom and Ian Spanik on guitars. Tom and Ian act like brothers, but actually they're father and son and the leaders of the rock band The Spanik Boys. Coming up, we talk with Tom and Ian Spanik, a family that plays together. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers the day Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Carl Perkins played together. And John Leonard reviews Our Grandmother's Drums. It's Mark Hudson's account of his 2 years in a village in Gambia. Leonard calls it a masterpiece. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Talks about budget talks continue today at the White House, where President Bush met with GOP congressional leaders. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
When President Bush called for a budget summit with Congress, he agreed to no preconditions, appearing to imply that taxes, despite his Read My Lips pledge, would be on the table. The White House is declining to repeat that pledge, instead indicating that no preconditions means Mr. Bush is not bound to previous positions. After a meeting, Assistant Senate Republican Leader Alan Simpson said the president did not talk about taxes.
He didn't talk about tax revenue. He talked about revenue. Revenue is in his budget. I know there's a great desire to grab the unholy word tax and wrap it around his head like a lavalier, but that isn't going to work.
Revenue, said Simpson, includes things like a value-added tax, taxes on alcohol and cigarettes, and a one-cent national sales tax. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
A fire on the USS Cunningham has killed one sailor and injured 12 others. According to officials, the fire broke out in the number one boiler room as the ship was located off the coast of Virginia. At one point, according to a White House spokesman, the fire spread to the Combat Information Center, which was then evacuated, leaving the ship without communications for a time and dead in the water. The main blaze was put out in 2.5 hours, while smaller fires were fought throughout the morning. The ship is now being towed to shore at Norfolk. The government has released an uncensored set of the personal notebooks of Iran-Contra figure Oliver North. As NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports, these notes raise questions about President Bush's possible involvement in helping the Contras.
The diaries show that on August 6, 1986, Oliver North met with the House Intelligence Committee. During that meeting, he denied helping to arm the Nicaraguan Contras. North later admitted in his trial that he lied to the committee. The diaries also show that North met with Vice President George Bush later that day when he was trying to keep information about his illegal supply operation from leaking out. The notebooks provide no details on that meeting. The president's spokesman, Marlon Fitzwater, said today that the role of then-Vice President Bush has already been examined by congressional committees. Investigators hope that the government will soon release another 1,200 pages of North's notebooks. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Carl Spitz Channel, who was convicted of illegal fundraising activities in the Iran-Contra case, has died at the age of 44. An associate says the conservative fundraiser died of pneumonia while recovering from a car accident. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 12 points to close at 2,733.56 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. There's a recording session that's been talked about for years, but could be heard only on bootlegs, the Million Dollar Quartet session. It's Elvis Presley and some of his friends, including Carl Perkins and Jerry Lee Lewis, relaxing and playing in the Sun Record Studios in Memphis in 1956. Earlier this year, RCA released the recording, and rock and roll historian Ed Ward says it's an unparalleled document of the times and the talent.
Is that no place like home?
There's no place like home. Well, now I say home.
It was December 4th, 1956, and the Sun Studios were abuzz with activity. Singer and guitarist Carl Perkins was finally out of the hospital after the auto accident that had taken the momentum from the success of his recording of Blue Suede Shoes. And earlier in the day, he'd come to Sun to cut another record, Matchbox, that he hoped would get him back on track. Sam Phillips, who owned the place, thought Carl's arrangement needed some beef and called in a young piano player, Jerry Lee Lewis, who'd just started recording for Sun. Jerry Lee needed the work. He was sleeping on his uncle's couch, and his first record had only come out 2 days before, so he was dead broke. By 4 o'clock, Perkins was sung out, so they ended the session. They were confident that Matchbox was going to be a big hit because in the middle of the playbacks, Elvis had walked in with a girlfriend and had heard the track and pronounced it great. Elvis was a huge star by now, but he couldn't help dropping by Sun to see his old friends. So when the official recording was over, he walked into the studio room and sat down with Carl and Jerry Lee.
You belong to my heart.
Remember that?
Now and forever. We were there beneath the stars while a million guitars played our love song. When they said I love you, every beat of my heart said it too. Solemn table of air.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Almost immediately, somebody turned on the tape recorder, and with some gaps where tape reels were changed, nearly everything that happened in the studio for the next 90 minutes was documented. They started off with gospel music, a common ground the three men shared.
Tempted
and tried, we're off made to wonder why it should be thus, although it
by now, there were more people in the studio, and nobody's quite sure who was doing what. But Elvis's voice is distinctive enough that it stood out. Everybody wanted to have Elvis record their songs. Even Sam Phillips pitched a song to him. And Elvis, sounding a little uncomfortable, agreed to listen to it. Nowhere is Elvis's newfound relationship to his fame more evident than in this portrait of Jackie Wilson, though.
Billy Ward and his dominoes. There's a guy out there who's done a takeoff on me. Don't be cruel. He tried so hard until he got much better, boy. Much better than that record of mine. Oh, no, wait now. I mean, it's this way. He was real slender. He was a colored guy. He got up there and he said, he had a little slow with me. Started off. He said, what kind of key did I do it in? What key did I do Don't Be Cruel in? He said, hey, you know I can't be found. Wait, son. Sitting home all alone. If you can't come around. And he had his feet turned in like this, and all the time was singing, and feet was going in and out, both ways, sliding like this. He says, hey, you know I can't be found.
Oh, man.
He says, at least, please, a telephone. Don't be.
It's evident that Elvis was in awe of the skinny young singer who was still with Billy Ward's Dominoes, still a couple of years from the records that would make him famous. Elvis's being in the studio was news, and while the tapes rolled, Sam Phillips did a very smart thing. He called the local newspaper, and then he called Johnny Cash, another young singer who, like Jerry Lee Lewis, was just getting his career going at Sun. A carefully posed photograph, taken when they arrived, shows Elvis seated at the piano with Jerry Lee, Carl, and Johnny with their mouths open, supposedly singing. This photo later gave rise to the name for this tape jam session, the Million Dollar Quartet, although Cash is heard nowhere on the tape and left right after his photo was taken. The Carl Perkins Band had a show that night, and they left, too.
That's why I hate to start in his jam session. I'm always the last one to leave. Mm-hmm. Always.
Pretty soon, Elvis left for the control room to talk with Sam Phillips and some fans, and Jerry Lee, whose ego can be heard trying to burst the bounds of politeness, did a one-man show for the microphone. Was, we hear somebody note, 5:30. It was supper time. Time to be with the family, tell them about the amazing fun you'd had this afternoon. Fun that, through some miracle, was preserved on a bunch of reels of tape.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Father alone will know all about it. Father alone will understand why. Cheer up, my brother.
This is Fresh Air. Every year, Fresh Air's rock and roll historian Ed Ward helps put together a music conference in Austin called South by Southwest. Last year, he chose to showcase a new band from Milwaukee called the Spanic Boys. According to Ed, they knocked everyone's socks off. They were signed on the spot by Rounder Records. Actually, they're not boys, but a father and son team that lead a rock and roll band. Tom, the father, played in rock bands until the early 60s. He gave up rock and later studied and taught classical guitar. Ian, who is 22, plays lead guitar, sings lead, and harmonizes with his dad. Here's Keep On Walkin' by the Spanic Boys.
Once the man will up your heart.
Tom, can you tell the story of how you started playing together?
We started at home when he was young. Just started messing around with the guitars, and you know, I taught him how to play and gave him music lessons, like let's say every night.
Yeah, right.
And just picked up from there. And as far as the band started, you know, as far as playing as a band. We just sat in one night with some friends who played, and it went over pretty good. And we tried it another time, and it went over good, and we started the band from there.
And how did you develop the harmonies that you sing with? Did you just start singing that way, or did you work out that style?
No, not really. I mean, I never sang before I was 19.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And Dad's real good at doing harmonies and things. Once we started doing them, it only took about 2 weeks for them to just start just happening right away, where we didn't have to work at them. Once I got used to doing the parts, and now it's at the point where we don't really have to work on them. We just can go through a song, and the harmonies will be there now.
Which came first for you, Ian, writing songs or singing?
Writing songs.
So you started singing because you had songs you wanted to put across?
Yeah.
And, Tom, what about your singing? Did you always sing in the early 60s when you were in rock and roll bands?
Yeah, I did. And I sang at the time I was in bands with my cousin. And we had close harmonies. And when Ian and I started singing, I couldn't believe how much, you know, how much tighter the harmonies were that we had together. And now everybody's been really focusing in on those harmonies. You know, a lot of it was on guitar work and things like that, and yeah, now it's been a lot of, you know, harmonies and how close it is.
Yeah, I think when the band first started, we were known as a real guitar band, as being just real good guitar players, but in the last couple of years, the songwriting and singing have just developed where I think our emphasis is more on that.
I'm gonna get on a ship today, yeah. I'm gonna have to sail away.
excuse. I'm going to the promised land. Lights will shine and the moon will be bright. Night will be day and day will be night. Pain will be felt, sorrow will be seen. I'm going to the promised land.
You had basically given up rock and roll at, I guess, around the time Ian was born, or maybe even before that. I can't do the math that quickly.
5 years before.
Okay. Did you ever think that, you know, when Ian grew up, you'd have somebody to play with? Did you ever think of him in those terms?
Well, I tell you, when he started messing around with the guitar, I always did have it kind of in the back of my mind that someday, we'd do some playing together. Yeah, I did.
What kept you fresh playing rock and roll? I mean, what kept your chops together playing rock and roll when you weren't playing it?
Well, I don't know. I've just always been the kind of guitar player that even when I went to the conservatory and studied classical guitar, I never had to work at things like for recitals or anything else. You know, other guys would go home and work for 16 hours a day. You know, I don't know. I guess I just never had to really keep it up on a weekly or daily basis or anything. I just always stayed there.
Why did you give up playing rock and roll?
Why?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just became real interested in classical guitar at the time. And, of course, I cashed in on my GI benefits and went to school on that. And thought I might as well use it. And I liked it at the time, but, you know, I got to the point where I liked the music, but I didn't like so much the other classical musicians' outlook of different styles of music, and I don't like that. I'm pretty open-minded when it comes to music.
Mm-hmm. Ian, was it hard to learn from your father at all? Some people really don't like to learn things from someone else in the family, whether it's driving a car or playing an instrument, because all this family stuff comes up in the interactions between student and teacher when you're family.
Sometimes it was, but not really, because I really wanted to learn, and there really wasn't a better teacher I could find or pay money to have.
Mm-hmm.
And he started me out. I mean, he didn't let me get an electric guitar until I was 15. He made me play classical. So,
did you like classical music?
Not really.
So did you resent that you couldn't?
No, I didn't resent it. I mean, it got me started in playing, and now I wish I could play it as good as he does, and I'm going to start taking lessons from him again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because now it's something I would like to learn, but at the time I wanted to have an electric guitar and play rock and roll. But, and I think it's probably good he didn't let me get one until I was older and got the basics, because there's a lot of rules in classical that just make for good training, and there's a lot of strictness involved in it.
I haven't met you in person. I should say you're talking to us from the Chicago Bureau, and mm-hmm. I'm in our studio in Philadelphia, so I've just seen pictures of you. But you're both kind of husky guys, and this is a period in rock and roll when so much of rock and roll has to do with, like, the right haircut
uh-huh.
and the right clothes and everything, and you don't seem to be fitting into that at all, or caring much about it. And I was wondering if you think that's working for or against you. There's so much emphasis on fashion and
uh-huh.
looking the part now in rock and roll.
Well, I think it has to do with talent. People are just so used to seeing men who weigh 150 pounds and have long hair and wear spandex. I mean, I don't understand. I don't see that has anything to do with music, really.
In some ways, it could actually work to our favor, because it does, it does make us different. And we've had people actually say, actually call the house and say, thanks, you changed my son's way of thinking from wanting to grow out his hair and wear earrings to, just look like a regular guy.
Thinking that he can look like himself without...
And,
I'd rather look like myself than try it and look like everyone else,
mm-hmm.
just because that's what people think you have to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of it's just a put on thing. I think we're real and we are what we are, You know, and everything just comes out of the energy of the music. And I think that's very important. Very important.
How many other people are there in your family? In your immediate family?
One.
So Ian, you're an only child?
Yeah.
So it's like in the whole family, it's just like Ian, your mother, Tom, your wife, who's not in the band. Does she feel left out?
Well, my wife's isn't Ian's mother.
Oh, I'm sorry for making that assumption.
Ian grew up with me, you know, alone together since he was 7.
Oh.
So it was just the two of us.
So I could see how you guys got pretty tight.
Mm-hmm.
Ian, how much experience do you have playing in bands outside of the band with your father?
This is it.
You never played just with bands without him?
No.
Do you think that you'll be together a long time playing together?
Till one of us kills each other, probably.
Does it ever get rough on the road when you're together all the time?
Yeah, it gets rough anywhere when we're together all the time. But we know how to handle each other. Besides, I'm taller than he is.
I'll have to bring him up for elder abuse charges one of these days.
Well, I want to thank you both a lot for talking with us, and I wish you the best.
All right, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Tom and Ian Spanik, their new record, Spanik Boys, is on Rounder.
Hey, Juliana, won't you be my girl? Hey, Juliana, won't you give it a whirl? Well, once, twice, make a sacrifice for a girl like you. I'll take you in my arms, and you love your charms, what I'd like to do. If I have to, I'll make those other guys let you be. Cause I know that there'll be a chance for me. Let's stop him, what's already started. So come on, little girl, won't you go?
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear news of the President and the Congress as they seem to be approaching agreement on the need for some kind of tax increase. Republicans in Congress are speaking of revenue enhancements once again. But it does seem that this week the White House has signaled President Bush's openness to talk of higher taxes. And a story about Pope John Paul II and his visits to Eastern Europe and his calls for an increased attention to spiritual needs in those countries.
Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Mark Hudson is an Englishman in his 20s who spent 2 years in a small village in Africa and has written about his unusual experiences in a new book called Our Grandmother's Drums. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Mark Hudson is not an anthropologist, a do-gooder, or an ideologue. But he went to Africa anyway, for a couple of years in the village of Dulaba in the nation of Gambia, on what he calls an adventure in consciousness, and he's brought back a masterpiece. You will find in Our Grandmother's Drums everything you want by way of the exotic. Empty skies and orange earth, termite hills and mangrove swamps, flame trees and goat meat, salt flats and pepper gardens. You'll also find harp lutes, calabash drums, snakes, baboons, olive green blister beetles, and lizards 2 feet long. Not to mention jujus, amulets, soul-stealing demons, flesh-eating witches, and the devil in the bush. But something else obsesses Hudson. It's the women of Dulaba, trapped in a continual round of childbearing, domestic labor, and manual agriculture, deferring all decisions to men they married by prearrangement, prevented even from fully participating in their own Muslim religion, circumcised to dull the edge of their sexuality. And yet it seems to him that Africa was a continent created by women. They are, in Dulaba, far from abject. They have about them, he says, a vigor and a vitality that makes their husbands seem mean, insubstantial, even shadow-like in comparison. In his seasons in Dilaba, wet and dry, harvest and famine, he learns a lot about politics and religion, about ceremonies of naming and mourning, about marabous, the holy men from the pagan past, and griots, the praise singers buried standing up in hollow trees. But it's the women Hudson needs to understand. He works alongside them in the rice fields, to a state of nausea. He listens to their stories. He lends them money and his hut. Not only does he discover the existence of secret female societies, organized by age group, but he's eventually invited to join one. Saniora Kafo, the Golden Chain. Membership in this Kafo lets him get closer to the underground ritual of the women than men are supposed to. His page is devoted to the appalling rite of female circumcision. Clitorectomy and the cutting of the inner lips of the child's vagina are not for the squeamish. But the mystery is what happens after what these women call the time of the crocodile. They celebrate with style songs and taboo stories. They fling themselves into fervent, maddened dance. They find in rhythmic seizures what Hudson calls the collective energy of the moment, and which the women themselves call kia, or sweetness. On drums, their grandmother's drums, they beat themselves into exaltation and exhaustion. In motion and sound, they recreate everything they know of themselves, from before the British, before the Arabs, and before recorded history. A blood bond. I can't begin to suggest the wonder and intelligence of this book. The prose is as rich as the material. Shy Hudson, accused by the men of Dilaba of coming to steal the secrets of our women, falls in love. Of course it won't work out. He is guilty, they are not. They belong, he does not. It seemed to me, he says, looking back on my life, that all my failures had been failures of generosity, that whenever the moment had come to show my hand, I had withdrawn it. This was why I now had nothing. But because of him, the rest of us have something remarkable, splendid, and wise.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine. He's also a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Our Grandmother's Drums by Mark Hudson. It's published by Grove Weidenfeld. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tui and Roberta Shurrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Groves.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with writer Hanif Qureshi. He wrote the screenplays for Sammy and Rosie Get Laid and My Beautiful Laundrette. Now his first novel has just been published. Also, Dr. Andrew Weil tells us how to be healthy without running to the medicine cabinet. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.